Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hey, America. I'm Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, an avid lifelong hunter, and you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And I'm happy to announce I have both of my co-hosts back with me today in studio, the world-famous Chris Gesualdi. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chad.
And fresh off the plane from France.
And not groggy at all.
Not groggy at all. Jesse Riley.
And sitting in my chair.
I didn't even notice that.
I didn't know.
Oh, no wonder you're a little cranky and bossing Jack around.
See, because we haven't been here at the same time, right?
Well, the coffee woke me up a little bit. Thanks, okay. Thanks, Jack.
As the, I don't know what I'm going to call myself, the primary host of the show, I guess, to put it politely. I love this. I love a little tension between you underlings, as I call you, you know, co-hosts. I like the tension. I think it makes you both better, right?
Right.
I can't believe Jesse just sat in your seat, man.
Man.
Well, she was on first class, I'm sure, coming back from France.
Too. Are you kidding? I was like in plebeian class, like you had to pay for the wine. I'm like, I'm drinking soda.
No, I'd pay. I don't fly, as you know. I mean, plus I'd have my flask that I would sneak in somehow.
Why don't you fly?
Because I'm afraid to fly.
Me too.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Get out of here. You're both afraid to fly?
Fear is a sign of intelligence, just so you know.
You have no chance of surviving.
All right, first of all, I jumped out of airplanes. I rappelled out of helicopters, and that is all stupid. And I'm never doing it again, and I'm not flying anywhere. If I can't drive, forget it. I'm not going. I don't care. Unless I'm drunk, and then I'll do it. So, but we're off topic already
because
I'm so excited to have you guys back. Jesse's trip to France actually motivated today's topic, and that topic is hunting in France. Traditional French techniques and the concept of the proud tradition of hunting in France and the wild game, French techniques or wild game preparation in France. We're going to talk a little bit about the whole culture of hunting and food preparation how they acquire their food they eat.
And the difference in the animals, too.
Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit about that. You know, the thing is, we were talking on the subway over here and this ancient, really, royal tradition of hunting dating back to the first kings of France. In some ways, I know, and Chris is smirking, I can't wait for you to jump in, is still practiced today. I know, I'm a revolutionary, and I'm talking about kings from France, but, this practice of these formal hunts are really still being practiced in France today. And they hunt everything there and we were talking about roe deer
and the red deer.
And red deer, which happened to be, you could Google it, but the red deer happens to be probably the most comparable deer they have in Europe to what we have here as far as white-tailed deer, or more accurate, probably muley deer as far as size, body type. They're big deer, where the roe deer, very, very small.
Very small and very agile.
Agile, a very hard hunt. Obviously, I've never hunted in Europe. I don't even like to fly. But you can do roe deer and red deer hunts here, but they're all caged hunts or fenced hunts, and I don't like that. But this proud tradition of also hunting a lot of wild boar,
right?
Rabbits, a lot of bird hunting in France. We have quail,
a lot of wood pigeon, pheasant, partridge,
gray partridge,
guinea hens.
Right. So, you know, and what I find fascinating about fascinating about hunters in France, it's more and it's a way of life here. I hope I don't offend any of the hunters there, but it's kind of no big deal in France from what I'm reading and what I researched. You know, they kind of wake up and it's about harvesting food, mm-hmm. bringing it from the field and sharing it with loved ones. And that's what I want the show to be about. That's what I'm trying to promote here on this show. So, you know, I have an affinity to what they do. It's not about, you know, you're not going to find, you know, here in the United States, mass marketing as far as the hunting industry. Who wears mossy oak camouflage? Who wears...
Well, you know, that's the funny thing, right? When you see people there, like on the fringe of the forest going in or out, they're not heavily camouflaged. That's a really funny thing, right?
Right.
It's like they're wearing, like, sometimes jeans, some waterproof boots that come just below the knee, and a nice waterproof heavy jacket.
Right, which comes from that tradition in royalty, you know, the first hunts. You know, back then, only kings were allowed to hunt. The royalty were allowed to hunt. The peasants weren't allowed to hunt. That was the king's animals.
If you look at, like, all the chateaus, in that area of the Loire Valley has hundreds of chateaus.
And that's where...
And
our
they
friend
were,
Jesse was.
And they're usually in an area that's highly forested that they cleared to build the chateau, and the forest remains around it. So naturally, there were fish in the rivers near the chateau. There were animals, land animals, and birds. And they had a formal hunt. And the other thing that's interesting there is that in addition to using firearms and bows, they still hunt a lot with dogs
right. And
with falcons.
Yep. I was reading about that. And so let's go back to this idea of this, basically what I'm going to call a community hunt, you know, what we would consider here a hunting club, a bunch of guys getting together, maybe leasing or owning property and hunting that property, where in France it would be more on, you know, in the towns or in the mm-hmm. areas where guys would go out at the beginning of the hunting season and they would do what's called drives. You know, they would put two guys or three guys, depending on the size of their group, the area being hunted, and they would be the stand hunters. And they would sit with their firearms, whatever they're using, and the rest of the hunters would go to the other side of the woods, the field, the area being hunted, and they would slowly start walking towards the stand hunters. And this is where the term, you know, stand came from, a hunting stand. You know, we recognize here as a tree stand for deer, right? We put up a tree stand. But the idea is there's a man standing there with a weapon and having mm-hmm. animals of whatever nature driven to him. You know, and this could be a rabbit drive. This could mm-hmm. be a deer drive. This could be a wild boar drive. We're just getting the animals moving to these guys. And I would call that enjoyable. I've been on deer drives where it is a riot. I mean, your deer are running past you all over the place. It's not my preferred method of hunting, but it could be fun. And it's also very effective, and I think that's why we see it in France, because it's about getting the job done and getting that animal down so it could be cleaned, put on, prepared, and put on the table.
Well, they still do things like the old-fashioned way. They have respect.
Yes.
They don't overdo it like we do it here.
Right.
It's almost like they have a brigade system out there in the woods, too.
I love that.
Yes.
Explain the brigade system for anybody who doesn't understand what you just mentioned.
It's an organized staff. You know, everybody mm-hmm. has a job and a position. And
right. And in reference to a kitchen, it's what we use, basically a chain of command.
Right.
And I respond to it, and I've always responded to it very well because I'm a military guy. I was in the Army, and that chain of command's got to be honored all the way up from the lowliest person in the kitchen up to the executive chef. And it comes from the French tradition of, you know, having this militaristic society, really. And that's it's still found today in kitchens, and it probably, and you, Jesse, you could speak to this better than me. It probably is reflected in the hunts, because Jesse was saying on the way here, she was looking into some of the requirements to go out and hunt in France.
Right. Well, it's interesting, right? Because there you've got the theoretical, part of the exam, and then you have a practical exam where you're out in the woods with a team of people who not only check your ability to properly, load and fire your weapon, but also to be able to identify different wildlife that are out in the field. But once you get that license, you have to then go out with someone who's held a license for 5 years.
Right.
So it's a way of forcing the hunting community to be formed for somebody. You can't just go out on your own and be the lone hunter. you're within a group of people who've been out, know what they're doing, and are then going to guide you. It's not like getting your license is the end of the process.
Right. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce it in French, but the American translation is pack of hunters. And that's the term. And I would imagine it derives from this fact that you must hunt with someone who's hunted for a while. And there's probably that brigade system in place and this passing on of tradition and regulation and, you know, honoring the animal at the end of the day.
No, that passing on of tradition is a beautiful thing. We don't have that here.
Well, we do, but it's less formal. My father passed it on to me.
Yeah, mine did too, but now it's kind of lost.
Well, we're losing it. We're losing in the way. But in the hunting community specifically, it exists. We were talking about it with Steve Marinello last week.
It's
if
a great
you tuned
thing.
In. If you haven't tuned in, listen to that interview, an amazing interview.
Remember, I was busy. I didn't have time.
You were busy. You were too busy. I know, working and whatnot. That's okay. I still love you.
Yeah, but like Jesse was saying, it's almost like you're an apprentice and you're a commie. They have such a standard that
right. That's
what makes their food and everything they do so good.
Right, which I have a lot of respect for. And in some ways we have that here, but it's a lot less formal. It's a lot less formal. You want to join my hunting club, you're a rookie, I'm going
to
ride you.
You
got
to be pretty to join your hunting club. You got to be promotable, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely, promotable. I like the way you said it. I don't know about pretty, but promotable for sure.
But get back to that idea of somebody standing there and the animal is being herded towards that person.
Right.
That reminds me that it's like a very old system of hunting.
Absolutely, and that goes along too. You had already mentioned dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so within that same concept of deer drives or animal drives, you know, rabbit drive, whatever you're driving, dogs would be used to locate these animals, specifically trained for certain animals or maybe all animals. So you'll see a lot of dog hunts. And the same idea is locate this animal, be as effective as possible in locating it. And what better way than to train a dog to locate the hog, the mm-hmm. rabbit, flush this animal, corner this animal, or drive this animal back towards a guy with a firearm, who could humanely harvest that animal for consumption. And that's the beauty of it. deer drives here in the United States, you know, while they will produce a record buck, you know, occasionally you'll hear about that. Usually it's does, it's young deer, it's young bucks, you know, spike horns, fork horns, things like that, because they're dumb enough to actually get caught up in a drive and be pushed to a hunter, where those trophy deer, you're not going to take that way for the most part. Trophy deer are going to be too smart to be driven into danger. They're going to alert to the drive. They're going to run away a little bit. And generally what they'll do is lay low, find thick cover, wait for you to pass or walk around you. They're very smart. So, you know, this idea of drives, whether you know it or not, whether you've participated in them or not, it's to consume the meat. It's about killing young does.
Mm-hmm.
Does in general, you know, those young deer, and it's not a trophy hunt. It's to put the animal down on the ground, and that's what this show's about. It's not about trophy hunting. It's about consuming, you know, wild game at the end of the day.
The other thing that was interesting was that you don't see a lot of tree stands. People do a lot of hunting, like, on the ground, and they find appropriate cover and then create a blind with, like, maybe camouflage fabric.
Right. And there's something to be said for that, too. The closer you could be to the animal during that time of harvest, right, there's the adrenaline, there's the, you know, the emotional draw of taking that animal on ground level. Where I've done it with a rifle, I've never done it with a bow. I've gotten very close to doing it with a bow, and there's nothing like it. As opposed to being 25 feet in a tree where there's still that adrenaline rush. But it's completely different being in a ground blind. I've harvested turkeys from a ground blind. And I have an emotional response to all these animals when I kill them. And the feeling is the closer you could be to that animal at the time of harvest, you know, and that's why, and I'm not against it, and I'm not putting anybody down who participates in hunts like this, but things like, you know, these hunts in the Midwest, you know, Montana and the open ranges where we're basically shooting animals, you know, 300 yards and sometimes beyond 400, 500 yards. I've never done it, so I can't say, but there's really no appeal. I believe there's no appeal to me to go do that. First of all, I was an Army sniper. For me to go sit in the field and then wait for an animal or spot an animal, glass, you know, they use binoculars, they'll find this animal, identify it, see if it's what they're looking for, and then range it and take a 400-yard shot at an animal. To me, I don't get the sport for that. I'm, again, not against it. No one get offended. Don't start tweeting me that I'm against something. I'm not. Go do it, and it's enjoyable, and it's hard. I'm not saying it's easy to make a 400-yard, a humane 400-yard shot on an animal. But for me, I want to be up and up close and personal. That's why archery, for me, bow hunting is the primary hunting. I want to be within 20 yards of that animal when I harvest it, and just for that adrenaline. You know, we're going to take a break here in a second, but I want to talk to you about something first. If you love Heritage Radio, which you're obviously listening to me right now, you have to help us out. We're doing our membership drive right now. We got to keep this. We got to keep this radio station.
So, how much is it
funded? It's $1 million or whatever you have. Bloomberg, if you're listening, stop worrying about the soda
and send
us some money.
How much to join?
It's a $25 student membership and a $60 basic membership.
That's the voice from God. Thank you, Jack.
By the way, Stephen Ranella did not get a coffee.
Right,
Chris Cheswell.
Would you like to respond to that?
It's better than Dunkin' Donuts. And, you know, I was served with a smile.
Very nice. And he's still raving about this stupid coffee he had to have before the show. But, guys, with all seriousness, go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and please become a member. Join the organization. There's student memberships, basic memberships, family memberships, premium members, super fan members, and VIP. Bloomberg, you're a VIP member. Come on, give us $1,000.
But your membership is less than the cost of the cup of coffee, right?
Probably, at the end of the day. By the time Jack, a trained engineer, producer, has to run and get him a coffee, you're absolutely right. All right, listen, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This song is called America by Four Lincolns on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hey, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano. I'm here with my co-host, Chris Cheswaldi and Jesse Riley, and we're talking classic, traditional French hunting, and now we're going to get into some preparation or this idea of food in France and how, you know, what Jesse experienced, what one of the best chefs I know, Chef Chris, thinks about French preparations and this idea of preparing game food in your kitchens at home. Jesse, so you were...
Well, like one of the big differences, right? Like the thing I can think of that's closest, like you think of like an air-dried Italian-style sausage, right? In France, they call it a saucisson. It's basically, I guess, the same thing. And what's really interesting is that there, you know, they have markets different days of the week in different towns where people can buy live game, right? You buy, you go to a place that has wild rabbit, and they prep the rabbit for you, cut it up, and you can get this air-dried sausage, and you can actually get wild boar and this same red deer, right, and donkey, you know, and pig-based products as well. But what I found interesting is that, like, here in the U.S., you cannot You can't hunt, you know, deer and go make deer air-dried sausage and sell it somewhere.
No, you can't. And that comes around from, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s. Hunters, basically, or hunters, people basically eliminated wild game from this country, most of the desirable wild game, turkeys, deer, elk, moose. We basically eliminated them through the commercial uses of these. And buffalo, Stephen Rinella wrote a book about it. The idea that we basically eliminated these animals from the playing field through commercializing their meat had to be put to a stop here. And maybe it comes from our capitalism, our thoughts of capitalism, our American drive to make money. I'm not saying it was a bad thing. I don't think these people were bad people. They were out earning a living, and these companies were trying to get a foothold, and they thought they were feeding people. But there was no restraints put on them, and they basically eliminated a lot of these wild animals. Luckily, you know, in I guess it was the 30s, we got serious about it earlier, really in the 20s, and the Pittman-Robinson Acts and government, and I can't believe me, every time I say the government did something good, it bothers me inside. But luckily, the government got involved and put an end to this commercial harvesting of wild game here in this country. And I don't know if it could ever come back, and I don't know if we could ever control it to the levels we would need to control it, maybe with certain animals, but I have no faith in government doing it properly. So I would say, you know, if you're not a hunter, and maybe I'm just being greedy, but if you're not a hunter, too bad, become a hunter. If you're not a hunter and you really want to experience venison, elk, turkey, wild turkey, all this, mm-hmm. you know, you got to go to a good quality farm raised company, you know, that farm raises these animals and go that route. And it's not bad to do. That's not a bad way to go. But yeah, that is interesting in France that they could do that without decimating the animal populations.
Self-control.
We're giving the French a lot of credit today on this show. I'm very proud of myself, and I'm proud of Chef Chris. Very proud of you.
Yeah, I mean, you want unpasteurized cheeses. They got it over there.
They have it. Jesse, as a matter of fact, not to change. Tell the story about you in the cave. She was in the cave.
I was in a cheese restaurant, and it was down in a cave. And you won't know this, but I'm like barely 5'2", and I could like conk myself out going through the archway in the cave. And I'm like, wow, I'm in a cave. This is great. I love eating in a cave. Too bad there's not flame. That'd be even better. So then we had raclette, which is a traditional French preparation, usually with potatoes or ham, and cheese, which has been warmed. So in a restaurant, they've got a raclette warmer, which has a long plug that goes on the table, you know, comes off the table, and a little metal tray that you, the consumer, put in to warm the cheese. So as an American, and I'm laughing, the first thing I see is, oh, there's a cord we could trip over, and I could burn myself. I didn't trip on the cord, but I burnt myself twice accidentally, you know, one too many glasses of wine. But I thought, this is great, okay, because I'm going to burn myself once or twice. It's not horrible. It's like a little sting, you know, maybe because you work in a kitchen, you don't care. But I thought, you know what the sad thing is that you can't do that here.
Right.
Because somebody's going to say, you're going to trip over the cord, and oh my God, you could get burnt.
Right. And they'll sue, and the company's out of business. The liability insurance would be too much to have a restaurant like that, especially here in the city. And that's sad for us.
And there would have been a sign on the arch saying, watch your head.
Right, which would have taken away from the whole idea of eating in a cave.
That's right.
Putting up signs. You're supposed to hit your head when you eat in a cave. Okay. I want to get into some preparations, some traditional French dishes. I want to talk about the concept of game preparation in France, and you know the whole concept. I want to hear your thoughts on it, how they tie in this proud tradition of cooking, obviously in France, with these game animals. Did it start there? Did it end there? Is it there now? Talk to me about this, Chef.
I've always loved French food. I've always worked in French restaurants with French chefs or French trained chefs. They use the whole animal, number one. Mm-hmm. Nothing goes to waste. You know, pâtés, sausages, head cheese, and feet and ears. They use everything except the hair. There's two classical dishes, and I always use this as a question to the students. One is called civé, and one is called salmi. They're both red wine stews. But the only thing that the difference between the two is civé is made with animals with fur, and salmi is made with from animals with feathers.
Hmm. Now,
that's a nice trivia question.
As far as it is. I don't know where I'll ever be approached with that question, but I will know it if I am. But why, though? So it's the same stew.
It's basically
it's just identified different
the red wine stew, you know, with the lardons and the pearl onions and the mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And classically, you finish them with the blood of the animal.
Yep.
But you can't do that here. Someone might get sick.
Right. Maya Bloomberg would be mad at us. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. The idea of a stew, perfect as far as I know for game animals, right? Why would stew be perfect, right? How about a little trivia question for you? The idea that these game animals are tougher, they're leaner. Thank you,
mm-hmm.
Leaner. A stewing preparation is really going to tenderize that meat on the animal. So that sounds delicious. Now, how would we serve this? How we go about this?
You serve it like a regular stew in a casserole, brought out to the table. They might serve it with a papadelle or a rice or something like that. Mm-hmm. But another thing I like about the French is that they're going to pair the food up with things that the animal normally eats.
Yes.
Hmm.
You know?
Yes.
They're not going to serve venison with a watermelon relish.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to serve lingonberries or huckleberries or chestnuts and stuff like
right.
that.
Right, things the animal eats, so it's totally connected.
That's a real connection. It's first class.
That I love. And I try to do that myself. Sometimes, I guess maybe because the way I was brought up or as a hunter, when I'm preparing, I always try to think that way. You know, that's just the way I've been, trained to think.
There's lingonberries and gin and stuff like that and red wine marinades, and the marinade now becomes the sauce. Nothing mm-hmm. gets thrown in the garbage.
Right. Now, Jesse, you're just in France. Did you experience any of this game on your table while you were there? Did you prepare anything?
Well, actually, I had a wild turkey.
Wow.
Now, we didn't hunt the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
He was the place we were staying. I saw him in the prior year and fed him, and he eats a lot of grass, doesn't get any corn or anything like that. And going back to the idea that the meat is leaner, When you break down the turkey, I had done a galantine, which is a very traditional method of taking out the bones and then stuffing the turkey and rolling it. The meat is not as mushy as our corn-fed fowl is here, right? So it's a very different animal when you break it down. I don't want to say it's tougher, but it's like it's more connected in a way. You know, when you get chicken and turkey here, it's like very soft,
right?
And when you break down the animal, it almost falls apart. And when you break down an animal that's been living outside,
right, surviving
and eating grass, that animal
and moving,
right, and moving, he has tougher muscle and it takes a more tender cooking.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, we got to get more, we got to move in that direction as a society, really, as people. I think we are.
Well, we can't be afraid to make things that take more than 5 minutes to cook.
And we shouldn't worry about, we can't eat this now in April when it's out of season till December.
It gives us something to look forward to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, that ties in with the whole hunting.
I'm so happy we can't make truffles here, you know, because truffles are
right
a beautiful thing, and it's, you know what time of year it is when the truffles
yep.
come out.
Right. Yep. Asparagus.
Why do we need to have truffles in May?
Right. No, we don't. And that's the thing. And maybe it comes from our, what do we want to call it, Americanism?
Spoiled little brats.
Yeah, spoiled brats. We got to have something every day because we can.
Well, I think people are like disconnected from the seasons and what grows in a particular season. And that's because of the way things are in supermarkets, right? It's hard for most people, unless they've grown up in a rural environment, to really know when are, you know, certain greens in season.
Absolutely. But it's not, to me, and I don't want to let, I'm not letting them off the hook, because get a card with the seasons and what's in season. Carry it in your pocket when you're mm-hmm. at the supermarket. Mm-hmm. Stop making excuses. Just because it's there doesn't mean we have to buy it and use it. And seasonality is important to us, you know. And if you're buying things, even at the supermarket, you know, I would first argue go to a farmer's market as much as possible in your mm-hmm. area. Find outlets, CSAs, things like that, and get involved in stuff like that. But if you're at your supermarket, pull out your little stupid card with all the seasons and what's in, and buy that stuff. That those vegetables, those fruits mm-hmm. are more likely to have come right from this area mm-hmm. as opposed to buying things out of season that were shipped around, picked early, injected with dyes, and then shipped halfway around the world so you can enjoy, you know, a raspberry out of season or something like that. It makes no sense to me. And let's be honest, the food, the vegetables, the fruit, whatever you are buying out of season is crap.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we want to try to find quality foods and put them on the plate for your family. I know it's hard to go out and buy food, prepare food, and then serve food, and then clean all the dishes and do everything you have to do. I know that's hard. I do it every day. But do it already. If you love your family and you care about the people around you, we got to start supporting this.
Can you imagine growing up, like you were saying earlier, never seeing a brown apple and saying, ew, that's gross?
Right. Well, what he's referencing right. here is I was reading something on the way over here about them genetically modifying the apple now so it doesn't brown. Can we be any more lazy? Really? With millions of dollars invested in genetically modifying an apple so it doesn't brown, so they could cut it for you and put it in a bag and send it. That is ridiculous. I'm sorry. All right? We got to do better than that, people. Listen, we're out of time here. And before I say goodbye, I want to mention our membership drive again. Please help us out here. If you like the show, we have many great shows. Heritage Radio is providing a service. Please get involved. Become a member. We have various membership levels, I want to call them, from student to VIP Mayor Bloomberg level.
But the basic membership is just $60 a year. That's pretty good.
$60 a year for all this great programming. It helps support the station. The station does so much for the community, the industry in general.
And you won't be targeted by the IRS, right? Mention that?
Well, we don't know. No, we'll see. We'll see when the Republicans come in. We'll see.
Am I going to get taxed for this coffee?
You should. The lazy tax that you didn't get your own coffee.
I think you got to become a member now. That's
You're not a member?
I am now.
All right, you better.
Double payment.
Jack, get his credit card on the way out, please. Listen, guys, thank you. I'm glad you're back.
Thanks,
love
Chad.
Doing the show with you. That's all the time we have. I'd like to thank Jack for producing and engineering today's show. You can always find archived episodes of The Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.